The only thing necessary for evil to prevail is that good men and women do nothing. I am simply a mouthpiece for good men and women around the world who want to make a difference. The engagement and the involvement of ordinary people is what is going to change our criminal justice system. Many have tried and failed, but the only difference between them and me is I'm bringing an army with me. This is Truth and Justice. Well, we finally made it. The final episode of Reply Brief. It seems crazy to think back about the first time I listened to part 14 of the Prosecutor series. I was mowing my lawn on a hot afternoon and just fuming about the way Brett and Alice were wrapping things up. And now here I sit, months later, in my office looking outside at the barren trees of a Michigan January. I've spent months essentially relitigating a case that I had already spent a year working through what seems like a lifetime ago. After reviewing part 14, I sat down and did a little reflecting before I began writing this episode. Was it worth it? Was all of this necessary? For anyone that knows me, you know that I'm a person who tries to always focus on the positive. I give people the benefit of the doubt, and I choose not to get sucked into most dramas if it's at all possible to avoid them. I try not to see the world as black and white, right and wrong. There's always multiple sides to every story and many shades of gray, and I believe that in general, most people, even those that I disagree with, I believe that they're doing what they believe is right. I've never really spoken about this until now, but I feel the need to share with you that this has been a difficult process for me. I've always prided myself on supporting people in their journeys, particularly content creators. The only reason that I've been lucky enough to make a living doing what I'm doing is because other creators supported my work, and I've always tried to pay that forward. And yet here I am. For months, I've been tearing down another creator's work. And if I'm being honest, I hate it. I hate doing this. And I'll likely never do it again. I even contemplated not even mentioning the prosecutors in this finale episode. Just deliver my theory and let bygones be bygones. But I just can't do that. There's too much on the line here. This isn't about differing opinions or analysis. As much as the prosecutor's fans want to say that's all it's about, it couldn't be further from the truth. When I woke up this morning, one of my listeners posted on Facebook that the Generation Y podcast had put out an episode that really upset them. Their take on a particular case was way off base the way this listener saw it. He said that he was getting prosecutor's vibes from them and wondered if he should stop listening. And that's what I'm afraid of, and that's why I'm taking these few moments to open up to you about how I'm feeling. Please, do not fall into that trap. If we're unwilling to hear out other people's opinions on anything, then we risk getting trapped in a bubble, in an echo chamber. Growth and understanding comes from a willingness to allow your beliefs to be challenged. Listening with an open mind triggers the kind of self-reflection that's necessary to truly understand anything, any issue. Justin and Aaron from Generation Y are both amazing people with huge hearts and have always proven to be fully committed to being accurate. They get things wrong just like me and everyone else, but they've always been willing to own their mistakes and, more importantly, correct them. And sometimes they might just look at the same set of facts as you and come to a different conclusion. And that's okay. Justin and Aaron do not give off prosecutor vibes. What we should all be willing to tolerate is a different viewpoint and a different conclusion based on the facts. But what I refuse to tolerate is manipulation, distorting and misrepresentation of the facts. Facts about a real case involving real people with real life consequences in order to persuade an audience to agree to a conclusion. That's the difference. That's why I'm doing this. I'm just using Generation Y as an example because it came up today, but the same logic applies to all content creators in this space. Be a seeker of truth and a champion for justice. Be open to opposing views because they just might be right. They may have caught something that you missed. Which leads me back to where I started this episode. Was it worth it? Yes, without question. I tried my best from the very beginning, not just to have a knee-jerk reaction to Brett and Alice telling the world that Adnan is guilty and we shouldn't waste our time trying to continue to pursue Hay's real killer. I gave them the benefit of the doubt. I tried to have them on the show and have a civil conversation about the case so that I could better understand where they were coming from. I listened to every word of every episode multiple times. I made the effort to hear them out. When they refused to have an open discussion on their analysis, that's when I really suspected that something was very wrong here. And that's what led to the reply brief. I wasn't about to just say they're wrong. I needed to go back through the case file, double and triple check everything they were claiming as fact, and do the thing that I've always vowed to do on the show. Expose the truth. And today is the day where I leave you to decide for yourselves what you think happened. So let's go ahead and get into the prosecutor's part 13, their final theories. This was a marathon of an episode, running for almost 2 hours. The analysis begins with Brett for the, I lost track of how many times it is now, circling back once again to the cell phone evidence. These two seem desperate to convince you that the 709 and 716 so-called Leakin Park pings are some kind of damning evidence. They come back to it over and over again. Ignore the fact that AT&T says you can't use those incoming calls for location. Ignore the fact that the judge that heard days of argument about the topic concluded that Adnan deserved a new trial based on the incoming calls being used for location. Forget all of that. Let's not even discuss the absolute impossibility of the phone being near Woodlawn at 7:01 p.m., where we see calls going out from both Jay and Adnan, 8 minutes before they're supposed to be burying the body in Leakin Park. In this episode, they come at the Leakin Park pings from a new direction. This time they say that just because the location we get from the pings isn't reliable, the data used to get that location is still reliable. Meaning that we can still rely on the tower and sector as being accurate, just maybe not the location. And boy do they sound convincing when they explain this. There's just one problem. The cell phone records don't give locations. At all. All they give is tower and sector. The phone records don't say that the phone was in Leakin Park. All they say is what tower and sector the incoming calls originated on. That's it, just the data. What the disclaimer says is that you cannot use that data to determine location. What they are suggesting here is just nonsense. So that's where we begin. Don't be fooled by it. From there, they move on to their usual disarming technique. Make you feel like they're really being objective. They say Adnan doesn't really have a motive, and then they list out the things that could indicate that Adnan is innocent, and they're very careful about the elements of the case that they list. Asia's alibi letters. Remember back to the several times they discussed Asia? How did they always end those segments? They always end it by saying, Asia doesn't actually matter. She's clearly lying, but even if she's not, it doesn't really matter because she would only alibi Adnan until 2:40 p.m. She's irrelevant. That's what they have repeatedly told you, setting you up for this moment. The totality of the evidence suggesting that Adnan is innocent, according to them, is Asia, the strangeness of Alonzo Seller finding the body, and the fact that Jay has lied a lot. Three things. That's all they say Adnan's innocence hangs on. In the last episode, they spent a lot of time clearing Sellers as a suspect, so it's safe to address him. They say Asia isn't really important, so it's fine to bring her up. And they've acknowledged several times that Jay lies, but also say that's nothing to be concerned about and it's perfectly normal. Then they address the cell phone evidence, but conclude that the incoming call situation is too confusing for anyone to understand, so we can't rule out those incoming calls. And then lividity, which they once again minimize and say there's not enough evidence regarding lividity to make any determination one way or the other. And that's it. They say that's all that Adnan has going for him. Overall, Adnan was a good kid, he didn't really have a motive, and he has those few items that might call his guilt into question. Which Brett follows up with, he thinks Adnan is absolutely guilty, and he says that the case against him is incredibly strong. But I want you to note the things that they don't bring up here, as though they don't even exist. They make no mention whatsoever about track practice. Coach Sy saying that he started a conversation with Adnan when he was stretching and then walked around the track with him. Or the fact that he said, as far as he remembers, Adnan was there on time and left on time. No mention of Becky overhearing Hay tell Adnan that something came up and she couldn't give him a ride, and him saying no problem and walking away. No mention of Debbie talking to Adnan about track practice in the counselor's office after school. No mention of the dated letter from the counselor. No mention of Debbie later seeing Hay alone about to leave school and telling her that she was going to go meet Don. No mention of Inez Butler seeing Hay get out of and back into her car alone as she stopped to get snacks before driving away. No mention of the sheer and absolute impossibility of any of Jay's stories when compared to the call log and the drive times. None of that cuts against the guilty narrative at all. We're just left with Adnan is clearly guilty, and the case against him is incredibly strong. Brett goes on to explain that from the very beginning, four elements of the case needed to hold up in order for Adnan to be guilty. You might remember this list from episode 1. Adnan gave Jay his car and phone that day. Adnan had Jay pick him up after the murder and dropped off Hay's car. Later, Adnan had Jay help bury the body in Lincoln Park, and Adnan and Jay dropped off Hay's car on Edgewood. Brett has said from the beginning that if these four things are proven to be true, then Adnan is guilty. Now, the first has never been in dispute. We all know and acknowledge that Adnan let Jay use his car that day. And the rest, they say they have proven because of Jen and the Nisha call. 15 hours of analysis, and all they needed to do on episode 1 is say that Jen had her lawyer in the room, and the Nisha call puts Adnan and Jay together when they would need to be together for Adnan to be guilty. Case closed. We didn't need months of a horse and pony show. In the end, that's all it boils down to for them. Jen and Nisha equals Adnan is guilty. Which really is a pretty big problem for them, because despite what they keep telling you, it is absolutely without question proven that the Nisha call was not Jay and Adnan together after ditching Hay's car. You can cry about that all you want, but the facts are the facts. It's impossible. It's literally impossible. But what about Jen? The reality is that Jen just told the police what Jay told her to tell them. She admits that. As she said in her most recent interview, everything she had to say was what other people told her to say. And when you actually look at what she said and compare it to what Jay said, the two contradict each other every step of the way, especially once they got to trial. But after 15 hours of investigative work, Brett and Alice boil the case down to this. When you compare Jay and Jen's statements, a quote, basic story emerges. Eating better is easier with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Becky and I have been Factor customers for a long time, and I'm telling you, every fresh, never frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, absolutely delicious, and the best part, they're ready to eat in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. And there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. So what are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. Fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever you are in just 2 minutes. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, dinner, or midday bites. I'm talking pancakes, smoothies, and so much more. These are no prep, no mess meals, just heat and eat. No time spent prepping and no cleanup. and you can get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. So sign up and save. They've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Head to factormeals.com/truth50 and use code truth50 to get 50% off. That's code truth50 at factormeals.com/truth50 to get 50% off. Have you ever tried to break a bad habit and felt like you're climbing Everest in flip-flops? Yeah, I've been there too. But here's a breath of fresh air. Fume. It's not about giving up, it's about switching up. Fume takes your habit and simply makes it better, healthier, and a whole lot more enjoyable. Fume is an innovative, award-winning flavored air device that does just that. Instead of vapor, Fume uses flavored air. Instead of electronics, Fume is completely natural. And instead of harmful chemicals, Fume uses delicious flavors. You get it. Instead of bad, Fume is good. It's a habit you're free to enjoy and makes replacing your bad habit easy. Your Fume comes with an adjustable airflow dial and is designed with movable parts and magnets for fidgeting, giving your fingers a lot to do, which is helpful for de-stressing and anxiety while breaking your habit. Now, I wasn't sure what to expect when I first tried my Fume, but what I discovered is that the flavored air tastes great, and most of all, it really scratched that itch that so many of us struggle with when trying to drop that hand-to-mouth behavior associated with the bad habit that we're trying to kick. Plus, Fume just released a magnetic stand for your Fume, so there's no more losing it around the house. It's built with fidgeting in mind. You can spin your Fume around on it. So start the year off right with the good habit by going to tryfume.com/truth and getting the journey pack today. Fume is giving listeners of this show 10% off when they use my code TRUTH to help make starting the good habit that much easier. That's tryfume.com/truth and use my code TRUTH. Okay, so here's how Brett and Alice say that Jay and Jen's stories line up to create what they call the basic story that emerges. As I go along, I'm going to be pointing out the elements of this basic story that they are just getting completely wrong, the elements that neither Jay or Jen say happened, and the parts that are provably false and they're pretending the conflicts don't exist. So here it is. The basic story is that Adnan called Jay. Absolutely did happen. Then Adnan let Jay use his car and phone. Again, that happened. Next, they say Adnan calls Jay while he's at Jen's house. This part is a massive problem because both Jay and Jen say this call happened at a time when it absolutely couldn't have happened. But also, there's no real clarity here. Jen says she's not sure if the call came into the landline or the cell. Jay waffles back and forth as to whether it happened on the landline or the cell. And he also shifts from the call came at Jen's to the call came at Jen's on the landline, to the call came after he had already left Jen's, to it came after he left but still came on the landline, landing on his trial testimony that the call came on the cell phone while he was at Jen's. And there is no call on the log that exists that could have been Adnan calling the cell while Jay was at Jen's. Brett and Alice don't peep a word about any of that, and just say that all that's important is the basic story that Adnan called Jay when he was at Jen's. Then, Jay meets Adnan at Best Buy. And of course, we'll ignore the other four locations that Jay says this meeting happened. Since Jen said Best Buy, the basic story is that the meeting was at Best Buy. Then, Adnan and Jay drive across town to the park and ride and drop off Hayes' car. Then Jay drops Adnan off at track practice. They completely leave out two things here that are consistent across all of Jay's statements. Going to buy weed, and then going to Patapsco State Park to smoke it before going to track practice. That element of the story completely disproves the piece where Jay gets Adnan back to track practice in time to have the conversation with Coach Cy, so we're supposed to pretend it isn't part of the story at all. See, that's how this works. You're supposed to ignore any and all evidence that proves Adnan is innocent. You're told that the only things that matter are the cherry-picked pieces of the story that they can make fit into a working narrative. So forget what Jay said, except for the parts where what Jay said helps their case. Next, Jay picked Adnan up at track practice, and they go to Christy's house. Never mind Jay originally telling a detailed version of the story where after track practice, he and Adnan went to McDonald's, where Adnan got some food to break his fast. Also, let's not pay any attention to the fact that Christy herself says that based on her school schedule, there's no way she would have been home that evening. While at Christy's, Adnan gets a call from Officer Adcock. We do know this call happened, but we don't know where they were when it came in. Jay says in one version that they were eating at McDonald's. In another version, he says they were sitting at Christy's, at a time when Christy says she wouldn't have been there. And Adnan says that he remembers that they were driving somewhere when they received the call because he remembers reaching across Jay and pulling the phone out of the glove box. But in the basic story that they say proves the case, they're at Christie's on the south side of the area map. And this is where a simple look at the map proves the rest of the basic story is absolutely, provably false. So Jay says when the call ended, which was at 6:29 p.m., he and Adnan were still at Christie's. That's the basic story. Now, in Brett and Alice's basic story, they jump from there to the guys picking up the car and the body. They intentionally leave out a stop that Jay says happened every time, and two calls that we know happened, and we know where they happened. From Christie's, they then went to the west side to pick up shovels from Jay's house. Then we know that they were up around Woodlawn from 6:59 p.m. to 7:01 p.m. That's when Adnan called Yasser, and the phone called another number that the police say was Jen's pager, but after a week of searching, I've learned that nowhere in the case file do we see any evidence whatsoever that that was actually Jen's pager number. We see where the detectives subpoenaed the carrier to find out who belonged to that number, but they conveniently did not turn the results of that subpoena over. Personally, I don't believe that call was to Jen's pager. I think that for the story to work, Ritza McGillivray needed Jay to page Jen. So they just said that was her number. And when they found out it wasn't, they just tossed the document that showed who it actually belonged to. And I say that for two reasons. One, there's no logical, innocuous reason for them not to include the response of the subpoena in the file. And two, these calls are seconds apart. So imagine how this goes down. Now, supposedly, the guys are on their way to bury a body. But Adnan takes the phone and he calls his buddy Yasser. And then he immediately hands the phone to Jay so he can page Jen. In the basic story, this is happening before they even know where they're going to bury the body. Why would Jay page Jen then? In any case, regardless of whose number that was, Brett and Alice leave those calls out of the basic story completely because it quite literally destroys their case. We know that the phone was making calls up near Woodlawn until 7:01 p.m. At best, if you're really trucking, get all the lights right, you have a 7-minute drive to the park and ride from there. It could be as long as 14 minutes depending on where they were at in the coverage area of that sector. But at best, the earliest they could have arrived at the park and ride to get the car would be 7:08. So if we go back to the basic story, they of course don't include any times, but I'm going to because these are the times that we absolutely know. They leave Christie's house no earlier than 6:29. Then they have to pick Hayes' car up at the park and ride no earlier than 7:08 p.m. Next in their basic story, they say Adnan and Jay buried the body. Again, they leave out the times. Their little trick here is to not give you the basic story and the call times at the same time. They blast through the basic story first, and then later they just say that the call log supports the story. But I'll get to that part in a minute. We know that because of the call log, the basic story is 100% false and easily disproven. What they don't tell you at this point is that Jay's actual story is that after picking up the car, they drive around looking for a spot to bury the body. Then he parks on the road while Adnan drags the body into the woods. Then Adnan walks back out to the road and gets Jay. Then they return to the body and start digging, and while they're digging, Jen calls the phone. That's the call they say was at 7:09 p.m., which is 1 minute after the earliest time that they could have arrived at the park and ride, which is at least a 4-minute drive from the burial site. Not to mention all the other shenanigans that had to happen before that call came in. It's also worth mentioning that at trial, Jay said that he paged Jen from the burial site, which again is provably false. There was an outgoing call that pinged a tower and sector that does not cover Lincoln Park at all. But then their basic story ends with them dropping the car off on Edgewood, and then Adnan dropping Jay off, and then Jen picking Jay up. And again, it's interesting that they list that as part of the basic story that emerges between Jay and Jen, when in reality, they never agreed on that. Jen has always said she met Jay and Adnan at the mall, and she talked to Adnan when they pulled up, and Jay has always said that Adnan dropped him off at home and left, and then Jen picked him up there later. How anyone can call those two stories corroborating is beyond me, but that is their basic story. And again, the sleight of hand here is that they don't give you the call log times during the basic story. They make it sound like it's a reasonable narrative with a logical beginning, middle, and end. After they tell you the basic story, then they say that the cell phone records support the story. And that, again, is the trick here. Rather than give you the story along with the call log, you get the story first, and then you're told the call log supports it. Then the call log, with no frame of reference to the drive times between locations and how those would actually fit into the story. So here's how they lay out the call log that they say supports the basic story. We'll start with the 2:36 p.m. call. This is the call that the state claimed to be the come get me call, but Alice says this was likely a get ready call or head to Best Buy call. And again, this is a good time for you to think back to a few months ago when I told you that by the time this is over, we'll get a new narrative that doesn't involve anything Jay or Jen said at all. Jay's never said there was a get ready call. He never said there was a head to Best Buy call. In fact, he's never said there were any calls before 3:30. This is completely made up with zero basis in reality or in the evidence. Alice just said that's a thing. There's nothing to support it. She has already decided that Adnan is guilty, and therefore she's searching for a way to make him guilty rather than look at what the evidence actually shows. Next, they move on to the 3:15 incoming call, which they give no explanation for. Then the 3:21 outgoing call to Jen, again, no explanation, because without question, neither of these two calls fit anywhere into the proximity of any basic story. Then 11 minutes later comes the Nisha call at 3:32, which they just say proves Adnan and Jay are together when they need to be together for Adnan to be guilty, which again, it doesn't prove that at all. We have a call to Phil at 3:48, call to Patrick at 3:59, then a call to Jen's house at 4:12. Now, Alice says this was from a tower near Jay's house. I'm not sure why, because it was actually from a tower on the very east side of the map, and his house is on the west side. Now, I'm not going to go through all of these, because they're not offering up any explanations. They're just reading them off so that they can tell you that they fit with the basic story. But they do offer an aside when they get to the 7:09 and 7:16 incoming calls that connected to the Lincoln Park Tower. Alice says that we should note that the only other time this tower and sector were pinged was on the day that Jay was arrested for an unrelated offense and Adnan called Patrick. That is a lie. Jay was arrested on the 26th of January, the day before, and released in the morning. The call connecting to this tower was during the time when the track team was practicing on the 27th. It was a call to Patrick, and as I've mentioned previously, that tower and sector cover Patrick's house. She says it was Adnan making the call. At best, that is unproven, and it's incredibly unlikely, again, due to the fact that all of the calls that afternoon were to people that only Jay knew, and Adnan had track practice. And one more time, we know from his teammate Will that it was a common occurrence for Jay to use Adnan's car during track practice and for Jay to then pick Adnan up in his own car. Now back to the night of the murder. The next call after the 716 ping is an outgoing call to what's been said to be Jen's pager at 804. Now, Alice points out that this call pings a sector that covers Edgewood Avenue where Hayes' car was found. Then, 1 minute later, comes a second call to that same number from a sector west of there. Now, I want to stop here for just a moment and break all this down. Let's look at the window of time that we have to go from calling Yasser and Jen up by Woodlawn to the car has been dropped off on Edgewood and the guys are headed back to drop Jay off. These are the things that you should be looking for in a basic story. We have two rock-solid anchors. The earliest time that they could have started making their way to pick up the car and the body, and the time when we know that everything had to have been over because they were headed back to the west side of town, away from all those locations. Now, we've already repeatedly been over the fact that there's no possible way for the 709 and 716 calls to have come into the phone during the burial, which makes them completely irrelevant. But ignoring that, let's first look at the actual story told by Jay, the real evidence we have to base a story on, and see how it compares to these calls that both Brett and Alice say match up really well to the basic story. So here we go. It's 7:01. Jay hangs up the phone from paging Jen up by Woodlawn. Next, they drive to the park and ride. Let's say that's 7 minutes to be gracious, so now it's 7:08 p.m. Then Jay says they drive around for a while trying to find a spot to bury the body. Again, let's be fair and say that only takes 15 minutes to find the spot in Lincoln Park. And that's being incredibly gracious based on what he said. So they pull up to the Jersey barriers at Lincoln Park no earlier than 7:23, long after the Lincoln Park pings, where Jen and someone Adnan was speaking Arabic to called, according to Jay. It's 7:23 now, and that's still much earlier than Jay's version, but we'll go with it. Next, Jay says that Adnan tells him to go park around the corner while Adnan drags Hayes' body into the woods. Jay says he's waiting from 15 to 30 minutes before Adnan comes walking back up to the car. So still, being super fair, let's say it was only 15 minutes. So now, it's 7:38 p.m. at the very, very super earliest. And now, Jay and Adnan are going to walk back to where Adnan leaned Hayes' body up against a stump after they had an argument on the road, according to Jay. So note that. In the absolute best-case scenario, the earliest that Jay and Adnan could have been together at the burial site is 7:38. And people are still talking about the 709 and 716 Lincoln Park pings. It's ridiculous. And really, in that timing, that doesn't give them the time to walk back to the burial site yet even. So let's say 5 minutes for that, because Jay said he was parked way up the road. So now we're at 7:43, and now they're at the burial site. Then Jay says it takes around 30 minutes to bury the body. There's puking, Jay sitting on a stump smoking cigarettes, more arguing, etc. So now, according to the actual basic story, it's at least 8:13 when they finish burying the body, which creates a bit of a hiccup. See, the next call in the log was an outgoing call from a sector that does not cover the burial site, at least 9 minutes before they could have possibly left the burial site. That call to Jen's pager was at 8:04. And then 1 minute after that, they're long gone, moving west completely out of the area by 8:05. And yet, they couldn't be, according to the basic story. They weren't even done burying her body yet by then. But as the basic story continues on, Jay says they now take off in search of a place to dump Hayes' car. And this takes a while. They drive all over. At one point, Jay loses Adnan and sits in a McDonald's parking lot for 45 minutes until Adnan finally found him. Then Adnan finds a spot to dump the car, but then he decides he doesn't like it and changes his mind. Finally, they land on a location that Jay never shares on the record. And then Adnan spends some time getting stuff out of the car. Then he gets back into his own car, and they finally head back west to drop Jay off. But first, they have to go to the mall to dump the shovels and Hayes' belongings. Then to Jay's house. And if you actually go by what Jay says, this process took like an hour and a half from the time they finish burying the body until Adnan drops him off. But again, in an effort to be graceful to the guilty crowd, let's say it only took an hour to do all this. I mean, it's 35 to 40 minutes of just driving, just looking at the maps to get to those locations. So only put in 20 minutes of buffer and say an hour. And that's if they just went straight to Edgewood, straight to the mall, and straight to Jay's house with no discussions, no delays, and no getting lost or driving around picking spots. None of the stuff he actually said happened, happened. So we'll say an hour, which would put us at about 9:13 p.m. when Adnan drops Jay off at home. And again, that's literally ignoring everything Jay said about that trip. I'm just cutting it to an hour because, hey, you might as well. Because the call log shows Adnan back by his house in the mosque on the phone to Nisha at 9:01. 12 minutes before he could have possibly dropped Jay off, and if you actually do everything Jay says they did in this basic story, it would be well over an hour before they were done. In no world could Jay and Adnan have been together making those phone calls at 7 o'clock by Woodlawn, be burying the body in Lincoln Park by 7:09, and be dropping the car off on Edgewood before 8:04. That is not my interpretation, that's fucking Google Maps. Hear what I'm saying to you. It is 100% impossible for that to have happened. There is no basic story. This isn't even complicated. It cannot be done. But how does Alice reconcile these call times with Jay and Jen's statements? Quote, "The call log maps on incredibly well to the basic story," end quote. Oh, does it? Wouldn't it have been nice if she actually explained how the fuck it mapped on so well? Instead, Brett follows up with, quote, "The cell phone pings are consistent with the general story told by Jay and Jen," end quote, to which I will respond, liar, liar, your pants are on fire. They absolutely are not consistent with their stories. Their stories aren't even consistent with each other, and the phone call pings completely disprove everything they said. And I keep saying they because Brett and Alice keep trying to use Jen to corroborate Jay, but Jen never said any of this. Jen only told the police what Jay told her. And she said she didn't even know Jay knew where the body or car were. All Jen said is that at some point she called Jay on the cell phone and Adnan answered, which may have happened. But we know for a fact that it didn't happen while they were burying the body. And these pings that are covering Lincoln Park and the car location, guess whose house is located right in between the car and Lincoln Park? Patrick's. Both of those towers cover his house. And this is one of my favorite lines from Brett. Quote, "The cell phone is everywhere it needs to be in order for Jay's story to work," end quote. Yeah, no shit. Jay's story was created based on the site locations. That's not an assumption. That's what the detectives testified to. In the second recorded interview, they say they showed Jay the cell tower map and he changed his story to fit it. So of course it fits the location, but what it doesn't fit are the times. You have these locations on the cell tower map, and when you compare to the times, you could see, yeah, okay, so if he drove through there, he would have hit that tower at this time and this tower at this time. But what they tried to do is say, oh, so he hit this tower at this time, and then he hit that tower. So between those two spots, since that's where we found the body, let's say he did 25 other things in there and spent an hour burying a body and all these things. That's where it falls apart. It's not just like someone remembering a time. They took locations and created a narrative that cannot have happened between those times. And again, I don't mean that Jay said that a call happened at 7 and it was actually 8. I mean there is not enough time to get from one place to the next and do the things that Jay said they did. Here is what there is enough time for. After the 7 p.m. calls, the guys head down to Patrick's house. They're at Patrick's or close to Patrick's when the 7:09 and 7:16 calls come in. They hang out for a bit, they smoke, and they drive back across town to drop Jay off. That story is consistent with the cell phone pings, not Jay's nonsense. ¶¶ Before Brett and Alice move on to deliver their final theories, they first have to once again make you feel crazy if you believe any other theory. They list off the things that they say you would have to believe in order to believe Adnan is innocent. You would have to believe that Jen lied to the police to protect Jay. And they follow that up with, there's no evidence that the police even knew who Jay was when they interviewed Jen. Now, I'm not going to go through it all again, but you all know how much overwhelming evidence there is that they definitely knew who Jay was. And in fact, he was the reason that they went looking for Jen in the first place. They say you would have to believe that the police would rather frame the honor student, an overall good kid, than the black drug dealer. And I'll say this, no one thinks that. No one thinks they targeted Adnan. They had no evidence. They threatened Jay, and Jay handed them Adnan. You would have to believe that the police had a perfect understanding of the cell phone evidence and used it to feed Jay a perfect story. No, you don't. There never was a perfect story. The story, in fact, is incredibly imperfect and actually provably false. And you would have to believe that in order to frame Adnan, they found the car weeks before and left it there, or that they put it in the perfect place where the cell records, quote, perfectly lined up. And again, no one believes they found the car weeks before and the cell records in no way perfectly line up with anything. This is all gaslighting. And remember what I've said these last few weeks. Pay attention to what they are choosing to talk about in this final, all-important wrap-up, and what they refuse to even mention. Somehow, in their final analysis episode, we get not one peep about track practice, or Inez Butler, or Debbie in the guidance office. No explanation, they just leave it all out. Now, they do mention Becky, but in the weirdest way possible, which I'll get to in a little bit. They conclude the "You're Crazy If You Believe" segment by touching on one of the cases where Detective Ritz's case was overturned for misconduct after the person he arrested was proven by DNA evidence to have been wrongfully convicted after serving 17 years in prison. So they're trying to convince you that it's not at all reasonable to believe that Ritz and McGillivray would coerce a false witness statement out of Jay. They point out that people have brought up other cases they were involved in as proof that they absolutely would do exactly that. And then they walk us through the Malcolm Bryant case. In that case, a man was stabbed to death. They didn't have any physical evidence, so they had to rely on witness statements. There were several 911 calls describing the offender, which Ritz didn't turn over to the defense. He interviewed a woman who said that she saw the murder, and the man who did the stabbing had bushy hair, like an afro. So from that vague description, Ritz had a composite created that looked like Malcolm Bryant. He then showed a picture of Bryant to the witness to have her ID him, which she did. Multiple witnesses from the scene gave statements as well as 911 calls, all describing someone who looked nothing like Bryant. All of that was suppressed by Ritz. And six witnesses told Ritz that not only were they with Bryant at the time of the murder, but also that he had his hair in cornrows, not anything close to bushy. But again, none of that was disclosed. He lied, and he hid evidence, and coerced a false ID. It then took 17 years for the defense to finally get DNA testing done that proved Bryant's innocence. So Brett and Alice tell that story, and acknowledge that all that stuff's bad, but then they say that pales in comparison to what people allege Ritz did in Adnan's case. Sure, he'll coerce a false ID, sure he'll hide evidence, but it's crazy to think he would coerce a false statement from Jay, for some reason. Now think about what he was proven to have done in Bryant's case, and think back to the things we're missing in Adnan's case. No phone numbers for the incoming calls. We have a subpoena to identify whose number was called at 7 p.m., but we don't have the results. He just says it's Jen's pager. We don't have Hayes' pager records. We have no interviews from the people Jay and Jen claim to have told the story to before the body was found. And we just keep wondering why these things aren't in the file. Just like Malcolm Bryant's attorney was wondering why the 911 calls weren't in the file. Why the alibi witness statements weren't in the file. Why the witness statements IDing someone fucking else wasn't in the file. But let's move on. I want to share with you a little bit more about these detectives. Here's three other cases that Brett and Alice don't mention. Focusing on Ritz first, in 1998 and 1999, he cleared 42 murder cases, meaning he made an arrest in a murder case 42 times and sent those cases to the prosecutor. 35% of those cases were never prosecuted. The charges were dropped by the DA after his arrest due to lack of evidence. Now here is another case we do have some information about. Ezra Mabel. Ritz again hid all exculpatory evidence in Mabel's case and presented two eyewitnesses who said they saw Ezra fleeing the scene of a murder. Because of this, he eventually had no choice but to plead guilty. What Ritz failed to disclose is that both of those witnesses first ID'd a different person, and he coerced them into changing their stories. After Mabel served 10 years in prison for this crime that he didn't commit, the DA reviewed the case and discovered that not only had Ritz withheld all the exculpatory evidence, but he had also threatened the two witnesses with drug charges if they didn't change their ID to Ezra Mabel. The prosecution in that case joined the defense in a motion to overturn the conviction once they realized what Ritz had done. Then we have the case of Sabian Burgess. Ritz is at it again. Burgess arrived home one night to find his girlfriend shot inside their home. He called 911 and then went to her aid while he waited for EMS to arrive. By presenting intentionally misleading forensics, Ritz arrested Burgess for the murder. He wrote a report saying that he interviewed the victim's children, and they told him that they were asleep in their bedrooms at the time of the murder and didn't see anything. Again, you have a weak case and an easy suspect, the boyfriend. So 19 years into Burgess's prison sentence, the DA looks into the case to find that the children had given statements to Ritz on the night of the murder that they had seen a man barge in and kill their mother, and that it absolutely was not Burgess who lived with them. They knew him. Ritz suppressed that and instead fabricated the report stating that the kids didn't see anything. It was also later discovered that a man had confessed to the murder, but since Ritz already had Burgess, he wrote a report saying that the confession was false. The man didn't know any of the details of the crime. But when reviewing the actual interview, it was discovered that the man told Ritz the caliber of gun that he used, where he shot the victim, how many times he shot the victim, and he also told Ritz that his accomplice had stolen a safe from upstairs, information that wasn't known to the public at the time. So, to Brett's question, why would Ritz frame a good kid over, as he put it, the black drug dealer? Because he doesn't give a shit. I've just shared with you three cases where the actual killer was identified, and in one case, even confessed, and Ritz could care less. He had his case closed, and that's all he cared about. Think about that. In all three of those cases, not only did he know for a fact that the person he was arresting didn't do it, but he even knew who did do it. Now, the last case I want to share with you is one from McGillivray. Just in case you were thinking, well, yeah, Ritz is corrupt, but surely his partner wouldn't have let him coerce Jay. Well, this case will help you understand that a little bit better. That's the wrongful conviction of Rodney Addison. And this one really rhymes with Adnan's case. In this one, three people witness a murder. There's a woman in an apartment complex nearby getting high at the time. McGillivray interviews her and forces her to say that she witnessed the murder from her window and that she saw Addison do it. That was enough. One eyewitness sent Rodney to prison for murder. A review of the case later revealed that all three people who witnessed the murder had stated with certainty that it wasn't Addison. He wasn't even there. And McGillivray suppressed those statements. It really mucked up his clear witness statement from the apartment above. He also suppressed the fact that it was impossible to actually see the murder from that witness's window. It was on the wrong side of the building. And the witness later admitted that she didn't see anything at all. The statement came entirely from McGillivray and his crew. Catch a person with drugs and force them to give a false statement to clear the case. That's McGillivray's MO. These two detectives do not care about lying and breaking the rules, and they do not care if they arrest innocent people. They have a documented history. So you can get right the fuck out of here with this, oh, you'd have to believe in a grand police conspiracy bullshit. This was just another day at the office for these two monsters. But after touching on Bryant's case, Brett concludes this segment with his conclusion. Adnan is guilty. Period. And then he delivers his theory about what happened. And his theory is shocking, to say the least. After all this research and all of this analysis, hammering away about how we know Adnan is guilty because he gave Jay his car and phone, he arranged the ride with Hay so that he could kill her. Hours and hours of Jay's basic story, and as predicted, the final theory doesn't involve a thing that Jay said. So here's Brett's theory. He says, this was not a premeditated murder. Adnan did not plan to kill Hay. This was a crime of passion. Let that sink in for a minute. Remember, the entirety of the evidence against Adnan is Jay's story, the basic story, which is that Adnan told him the night before and then again on the day of that he was going to kill Hay. Adnan left Jay with the car and phone to pick him up after he killed Hay. That was supposed to be the reason that he gave Jay the car and phone. Jay even said that he told Jen that Adnan was going to kill Hay before it happened. The entire fucking story revolves around Adnan making this elaborate plan, including calling Nisha and showing up to track practice to create an alibi. And Brett's final theory disregards all of that. He says that Adnan took Hay to Best Buy to ask her to prom, she rejected him, and then he killed her. And then we have a couple of insane flip-flops. Remember how everyone, all of the witnesses at the school, had to have had the wrong day. Well, Brett says that he now thinks Becky actually did have the right day. She did witness Hay tell Adnan something had come up and that she couldn't give him a ride, but he now says he believes that Adnan then persisted and convinced her to give him a ride anyway, with absolutely zero evidence to back that up. I mean, what Becky said was that Adnan just said, no problem, I'll get one from someone else, and that he walked away, and then Hay walked away in the opposite direction. That's what's in evidence. But in Brett's theory, somehow, somewhere, Adnan finds Hay again, with no one else around, and convinced her to give him that ride. And then comes my favorite flip-flop of the entire series. Remember Brett saying these words?
Does everybody understand what happened here? So Asia sends her first letter, right? Adnan gets that letter. He reads the letter. He then writes a letter for her to send back to him that he's going to use. I mean, this is 100% what happened. Like, people can disagree with me and say I'm speculating all they want. This is 100% what happened. He wrote the letter.
Well, guess what? Now Brett says he thinks Asia is telling the truth and that Adnan was in the library with her, and that's where he called Jay from at 2:36. Even though Jay says there never was a 236 call from Adnan. And this is bananas. Brett spent four different episodes trying to prove that Asia was lying, all to conclude that he now believes her and she's telling the truth. And my favorite part of his theory is this. The thing that he says, quote, sealed the deal for him, the one piece of evidence that sealed in his mind that Adnan definitely killed Hay because she rejected him, and that's the single rose and baby's breath that were found in the back of Hay's car. Adnan was making a grand gesture, just like he did when he gave her a rose in class months before. And if you're wondering why you've never heard about these flowers in the back of Hay's car, that's because there were no fucking flowers in the car. Brett picked up on a Reddit post that showed in the police inventory that they collected floral paper with rose and baby's breath. But he didn't actually research what that meant. It's explained in detail later at trial, and we have the pictures. It was paper with roses and baby's breath printed on it. Get it? Floral paper with roses and baby's breath? No actual flowers. So the piece of evidence that, quote, sealed the deal for Brett didn't actually exist. So that's Brett's theory. Forget everything Jay said. Forget about the plan with the car and the phone. Adnan asked Hay to prom. She rejected him and he flipped out and killed her. Oh, also, Adnan was driving Hay's car. That's how he got her to Best Buy. And also, she kicked off the windshield wiper lever during the struggle, the lever that we know for a fact wasn't actually broken. So then we move on to Alice. She disagrees with Brett. She agrees that Adnan gave Hay a choice, but that he knew that if she chose wrong, he was going to kill her. She paints a picture of Adnan being the absolute worst human that you could imagine. Dark and full of murderous rage. He felt like he owned Hay, and the reason that he feels no remorse is because he's so sick and twisted that he blames Hay for her own murder. She says Adnan presented her a choice. Take him back or die. And Hay chose to die. She tells a horrible story that'll put the hairs up on the back of your neck. None of which is supported by a single shred of evidence. Jay never said that Adnan was going to ask her to take him back, or that he was full of murderous rage for that matter. He just said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to kill her. Today, after school. Becky saw them together that day. Hay said she couldn't give him a ride, and Adnan said, no problem, and went about his business. All of Hay's friends said that she and Adnan still got along great as friends after the breakup. Even Don said Adnan was nice when he met him when Hay's car broke down. Now, you might speculate that Adnan was hiding this murderous rage deep down inside, but there's zero evidence to suggest that. Alice delivers a final theory completely void of any evidence. She tells you what Adnan was thinking and how he justified the murder based on nothing, based on her own imagination. And this part of the episode is what scares the shit out of me in regards to these two actually prosecuting real cases. Alice told a story that would enrage any juror who listened to it. And rather than repeat what I've been saying for years, I'll quote Brett and Alice. They always say, at trial, the best story wins. It's all about the closing arguments. And that story was horrific and believable the way Alice told it. It was designed to make you hate Adnan. But it was built out of thin air. And worse yet, it was nothing but a bullshit act. If you listen to the episode, listen to how she ends it. Full of hate and anger. In Adnan's mind, it was Hay's choice to die. And 3 seconds later, she burst out into hysterical laughter. It's an act. It's always been an act. After spending all these hours over all these months with their two voices in my ears, that's my final conclusion. My final reply to their series. This has all been an act. A pathetic attempt at getting clicks and ad dollars. These are two incredibly bright people. They're too smart to have missed the mark by this far. And I don't mean that they just came to a different conclusion than me. You can see if you're paying attention that they know where the problems are. They know that Coach Tsai is a clear alibi, so they avoid him. That's not getting it wrong. It's being smart enough to recognize a problem and avoiding it. They know that the times and locations on the call log rule out the Nisha call. And they know that the same is true about the Leakin Park pings during the burial. They know that. So they took the time to create a plan that disconnects the elements that contradict each other. They know that Asia isn't actually a problem. Since the 2:36 call means nothing, her alibi till 2:40 means nothing. So they continue to draw your attention to her. They want us arguing about Asia because they don't want us paying attention to everything else. And they absolutely know that Jay's story compared to the call log completely disproves the entire narrative. So in what was hailed to be the deepest dive and most thorough investigation of the case anyone has ever heard, they never spent a single minute trying to test the narrative against the evidence. Instead, what they do is tell you over and over again, don't get caught up in Jay's stories, and don't be distracted by the times in the stories. And it all comes together in the way that they end their series. They, Brett and Alice of the Prosecutor's Podcast, are the final word. They say that now that they have stepped in and shared the real truth about the case, everyone should now stop talking about it. They actually say that. This is the final word. Now we know Adnan is guilty, and it's time to leave it at that and move on. This was no difference in opinion. This wasn't unintelligent people getting things wrong. It was exactly the opposite. It was extremely intelligent people without morals. I've really hemmed and hawed about doing this. In fact, at one point, that last segment was going to be the conclusion of this entire series. But I decided to close things out by showing you how a theory is supposed to be constructed, based on evidence. Before I share my theory with you, I want to make this crystal clear. In no way am I saying that this is what happened. That's not how theories work. I operate using the scientific method, which is how all investigators should operate. I examine all the evidence. I then consider that evidence to form a theory. The next step is to backtest that theory against all known data to see if there are any flaws. Is there anything that exists that disproves the theory? If not, then I would move on to the next stage, which is to identify elements of the theory that could be proven without question and go out and find that evidence for a final test. A theory is not the end of an investigation. It's like the halfway point. So here's mine. Based on the statements from Hay's friends, where Hay said that at lunch she was thinking about Don, and after school when she told Debbie that she was going to go meet Don, I think that that's exactly what Hay went to do when she left school. The backtest here is multi-layered. Now, we do have Don's timesheet saying that he was at work that day, but we've been through all the problems with that. One of which is that there was no lab tech on the schedule for that day for him to fill in for. Another layer of the backtest is that Don, in a later interview, said that Hay wanted him to call her in sick to school so they could spend the day together. Well, they couldn't spend the day together if Don was supposed to be at work. Ultimately, that element of the theory isn't proven, but it also isn't disproven. And that's what we're looking for when testing a theory. Is it disproven? And in this case, it isn't. So my theory is that Hay left school to meet Don, and she left alone. That is supported by every witness that saw her that day. She said something came up, so she couldn't give Adnan a ride. She said she was going to go meet Don. She was at the snack stand alone with her car running. She left alone. Based on the profile that I shared last week, I believe the offender had a known personal relationship to Hay. I believe that the murder was unplanned, and I believe it happened at a place that could be directly connected to the offender. Based on that profile, my theory is that Hay met Don at a hotel somewhere near the school. Not only would this be a place that he couldn't leave her body and car, but when we look through the case file, we see that for some reason, the police were almost immediately looking for Hay at hotels and motels. The very next day, Adcock's report says that they were searching hotels and motels for her car. They had some reason to believe that they might find her at a motel. Unfortunately, they didn't check any registrations for any suspects. They just looked for her car. We also have the fact that in the recorded interview with Debbie, they were also asking her about hotels. There's something here that we're missing, I think, about a hotel, about information that Hay was at a hotel. So that's my theory, is that Hay met Don at a hotel or motel after school, and that something went wrong. Based on the medical evidence, I think that he knocked her unconscious, and then he strangled her. I think that he would have left her body there, face down, and fled the scene. I think that he would have confided in his parents, and they, either his mother or father, or both, came up with the plan to move the body and car. They did so much later in the evening under the cover of darkness. That element is not supported by any actual evidence other than lividity. I'm basing that element primarily off of my own profile of the scene. So remember, it's just a theory. It's not fact. I don't think Hay was actually buried that night. I think her body was put into a truck or a van, and the first priority was to get her car out of there and the body away from the motel. I believe the car was moved to the satellite parking lot at the airport, and the plan was to hope that the police would think that Hay had run away. My theory is that Don slipped up when talking to the PIs, where he really exposed his immaturity. He was young and nervous, and Mandy Johnson conducted a much more thorough interview than the police did. She pushed him to the point where he got so nervous he all but revealed the plan. He told Johnson that Hay wanted to go to California, that she might park her car in the satellite lot at the airport and fly. I believe that in order to protect Don, his mother created a time card to alibi him. And I think that Don is the luckiest person on the planet. The Baltimore County officer had no clue that it was his stepmother who alibied him. And there just happened to be two detectives working the case with a track record of not caring if they got the right person. The question has been asked, why would the detectives move the car if they found it where Don said it was? I would respond with, why would Ritz arrest Sabian Burgess when the victim's children saw the killer and said it wasn't Sabian? And why wouldn't they just arrest the man who confessed and knew every intimate detail of the crime? Why would McGillivray arrest Rodney Addison when he had three eyewitnesses identifying someone else? Same story with Ezra Mabel and Malcolm Bryant. In all of those cases, they had the evidence they needed to arrest the actual killers. But instead, they lied, fabricated evidence, and suppressed everything exculpatory in order to clear the case. They would move the car because they already had their guy, and that's what they do. That's what they have been proven to do over the years. So that's my theory. I think this case is much more simple than this elaborate story about planning a murder with no weapon, arranging a ride, getting an acquaintance to lay in wait for a come-get-me call, a trip to track practice, a call to Nisha, stopping at a friend of a friend's house for absolutely no reason, an impossible timeline, everyone at the school remembering the wrong day. It's not that complicated. My theory is that Hay did exactly what she said she was going to do after school. She went to meet Don, something went wrong, he killed her, he left, and he returned later with a parent to clean up his mess. That is a basic story. And where does that leave us? The final phase. Gather the necessary evidence to either prove or disprove that theory. Unfortunately, I don't have the authority to do that, and it may be too late for some of it. If I was a detective and this was 1999, I would go to every hotel in a 10-mile radius and check the registrations to see if Don or Hay rented a room that afternoon. I would pull Hay's pager record to see if she had any contact with Don during the day. I would get a warrant to find out if the time card was created after the fact. I would have checked the satellite parking lot the minute Don suggested it. I would interview Don's parents and check their alibis. I would interview everyone who worked at LensCrafters that day. And I would compare the DNA found on Hay's body to Don and his parents. That's what it would take to prove a theory. So when people say that I'm accusing Don or his family of murder, that's not true at all. It's just as likely that I'm wrong as it is that I'm right. This is just a theory. It's the most logical conclusion I can draw from the evidence that we have. But I want to be very, very clear. This theory is untested. It is not proven. And I hope and pray every day that someone is able to step up and do the right thing, to see this investigation through to the end and reveal the truth once and for all and finally deliver real justice for Haman Lee. And that concludes my reply brief. I sincerely thank each and every one of you for listening and refusing to allow injustice to stand unchallenged. Keep the faith, my friends. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at putthemina.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of createdintandem.com designed, created, manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kay Woodyomnik, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. If you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny, and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod, and I can be found on social media @BobRuffTruth. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.